Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 380, titled Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 3. This is being recorded on September 30th of the year 2002. We're going to plunge right into the subject material. Bear in mind that if the presentation that I'm unloading here is overly dense or overly pedantic, I can appreciate that. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated article-length description listing all of the sources and with excerpts of the text on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Be aware that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older shows are available for download only at a URL that's linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website that is also equipped with Real Audio and the download-only URL maintained by WFMU. Now, vis-a-vis Iraq and the Nazi/neo-Nazi connection that I've been speaking about, one of the things to consider in connection with Iraq and in connection with the long discussion that I've engaged in vis-a-vis September 11th, and that is the question of the United States being drawn into a war not only with the underground Reich, which has extensively penetrated the United States, in particular vis-a-vis the Bush administration, as I've said in so many shows, but which also is attacking the United States, in my considered opinion, in conjunction with its Islamo-fascist and Arabo-fascist allies. And that is obviously a very complex hypothesis. Numerous programs that I've talked about in connection with September 11th will present the information upon which my hypothesis is based. One of the important concepts in evaluating the working hypothesis that I've been presenting vis-a-vis September 11th, and that is the fascist third position. The third position is a fascist ideological stance which seeks to combine both extreme right-wing and extreme left-wing political ideologues in the so-called First World with nationalist movements in the so-called Third World in an anti-American and ultimately pro-national socialist political front. One of the things that looms in connection with the U.S.-Iraqi confrontation, that is basically a third position manifestation which has drawn a number of leftists in Europe or third positionists in Europe into a de facto political alliance with not only so-called neo-Nazis, but also with Islamist, and secular Arab nationalist movements in the Middle East. One of the people whose program is exemplary of this sort of third position, anti-American, pro-underground right coalition, and I believe just such a front is confronting or is actually engaging the United States, not only with regard to September 11th, but perhaps with regard to an attack on Iraq and perhaps resulting retaliation against Israel and or the U.S., a la Serpent's Walk. And that is a fellow named Jean Thiriart, T-H-I-R-I-A-R-T. And Thiriart, in many ways, exemplifies the anti-American and right-left fusion of the third position. There are two miscellaneous archive shows dealing with the third position available from Spitfire, M19 and M21, and I want to note the third position as a very important concept in the analysis of Iraq. Of Thiriart, his pro-PLO connections, his connections in turn to George Habash of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in turn connected very strongly to François Genoux, a post-war underground Reich operative of consummate importance, although not generally recognized. Martin A. Lee writes as follows in his landmark volume, The Beast Reawakens. And this book, as well as Kevin Coogan's old magnum opus, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, are both in print, and for listeners to flesh out their understanding about the very complex hypothesis I've been presenting here, I recommend both books very strongly. Thiriart, his third position stance, his anti-Americanism, and his pro-Iraqi and pro-PLO stance, Martin Lee writes as follows. In 1968, Tirial visited several Arab countries in an effort to win support for his idea of a European brigade, which he envisioned as the embryo of a future guerrilla war that would engage in armed struggle against the American occupation forces on the continent. He sought to convince his Arab hosts that it would be to their advantage if the United States became embroiled in a blind war in Europe against a terrorist enemy both invisible and ever-present, unquote. With this in mind, Tirial traveled to Iraq, where officials of the ruling Ba'ath Party received him warmly. After denouncing Zionist-American collusion in the Middle East, unquote, at a Baghdad press conference, he conferred with an up-and-coming Iraqi colonel named Saddam Hussein. Iraqi leaders were all ears when Tirial spelled out his plan for a European military force to assist the Arabs in their fight against Israel. In addition to helping the Arab cause, Tirial's young recruits would gain valuable combat experience that would presumably serve them well when they returned to Europe to take on the Americans. According to Tirial, the Iraqis were enthusiastic, but the Soviet Union nixed the proposal. Iraq had no choice but to comply, given that it was largely dependent on the USSR for military aid. By the way, one of the names in connection with what you're about to hear is Otto Ernst Rehmer, a key operative of the post-war Odessa SS Underground, and also an individual who worked very closely with Islamo-fascist and secular Arabo-fascist elements in the Middle East, working alongside of his associate, the aforementioned François Genoux. Turning again to The Beast Reawakens. After Israel's victory in the 1967 Six-Day War, a mood of desperate militancy engulfed the miserable Palestinian refugee camps. Deprived of a homeland and faced with an implacable enemy, Palestinian leaders apparently felt they couldn't afford to turn down offers of help, no matter how unsavory the donors. Arab revolutionaries were continually approached by neo-Nazi suitors, dismissing the distinction between Jews and Zionists as, quote, a subtlety for intellectuals, unquote. Tirial forged a close relationship with George Habash, head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which hijacked several commercial jets and engaged in other international acts of terror and sabotage. By the way, we've looked at the PFLP and its connection with François Genoux and among other programs, for the record, 333 and in number 350. Continuing. According to Luc Michel, Tirial's secretary, quote, Habash gave money to Tirial's La Nation Européenne, and Tirial supported Habash in this magazine, unquote. And in a footnote, Martin Lee adds, in addition to his ties with Tirial, Dr. Habash collaborated with François Genoux, a shadowy Swiss banker with extensive neo-Nazi connections. Described by Otto Ernst Rehmer as, quote, a very important person, unquote, Genoux became an early member of the Swiss Nazi Party and worked for German military intelligence during World War II. Somehow, Genoux was able to secure the posthumous rights to all the writings of Hitler, Goebbels, and Martin Bormann. And François Genoux had, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. Now, one of the things which is helping to ally the peoples of the Middle East in an anti-American and, I believe, pro-underground Reich position, and this is something we've spoken about before, and that is, of course, the Israeli-Palestinian question, and there is no shortage of fascist elements in the heritage of Yasser Arafat, head of the PLO. PLO, by the way, financed primarily by Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinian Authority financed primarily by the European Union, chiefly Germany. Returning to The Beast Reawakens, of the connections between the aforementioned Odessa leader, Otto Ernst Rehmer, and Yasser Arafat, himself a protege of Otto Skorzeny, the head of the Odessa, and Yasser Arafat also a relative of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, we read as follows in The Beast Reawakens. While based in Damascus, Syria, Otto Ernst Rehmer was in contact with Yasser Arafat, chief of the Palestine Liberation Organization. I know Mr. Arafat quite well, natürlich, he asserted. I saw him many times. He invited me to eat at his headquarters. I knew all his people. They wanted many things from us, unquote. For Rehmer, anyone who was an enemy of Israel was his friend, particularly when a profit could be turned. He claimed to have brokered several business deals between West German companies and the PLO. Skipping down. Tirial continued to view the Palestinian struggle as a springboard to pursue his dream of a pan-European revolution. But after seeking financial and material support from the Chinese and several Arab states, he had little to show for his efforts. Otto Skorzeny told a dejected Thiriat that his plan for a guerrilla army, however admirable, would never work. Having no wish to be a grand theorist to whom no one of significance paid attention, Thiriat decided to take an extended leave from political activism. Throughout the 1970s, he stayed out of the limelight, giving only a few interviews in which he pounded home his anti-American message. Quote, "The whole of Europe, from Stockholm to Naples, must know about each American who was killed within 48 hours of this event," Thiriat told a French reporter, again quoting, "European unity will come about only when 200 or 300 American occupiers are killed in every corner of Europe, just to prove our point. Then there will be no going back," unquote. And I would suggest that in the background of the events around September 11th, and also around the events looming in Iraq, I would suggest that just such a Thiriat third-position anti-American stance may very well be being realized. Now, in the next passage of The Beast Reawakens that we're going to examine, I want listeners to note very carefully the coincidence of policy between the Kohl regime in Germany, and bear in mind that it was the son of Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the architect of German reunification, Günter Strassmayr, the aforementioned Andreas Strassmayr, who was, according to Carol Howe, an ATF infiltrator, the mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing, and Timothy McVeigh was his mentor. Bear in mind the evidentiary tributaries linking both World Trade Center attacks to the Oklahoma City bombing, and we've spoken about that in many programs in the past. Now note the coincidence between neo-fascist and neo-Nazi policy towards Saddam Hussein's Iraq during the Persian Gulf War in the early 90s and the policy of the Kohl government as well. Note also that Franz Schoenhuber, the head of the Republikaner Party, a neo-Nazi party in Germany, and Jean-Marie Le Pen, the head of the Front National in France, both of whom were in attendance at a Swiss meeting at Mont Pelerin, along with Ahmed Huber of Al-Taqwa, as we looked at in, for the record, 377 and 378. Note that two of the people mentioned in the passage I'm about to read, again, Franz Schoenhuber, head of the Republikaner Party, and Jean-Marie Le Pen, were part of this neo-fascist and neo-Nazi pro-Iraqi element. Turning to The Beast Reawakens, as the United States rattled its saber and threatened Baghdad, Nazi leader Michael Kunin contacted the Iraqi embassy in Bonn. By the way, Michael Kunin, one of the top German so-called neo-Nazi leaders. Of Kunin, Martin Lee writes, "His overtures culminated in a memorandum of agreement with Iraqi officials, which stipulated that Baghdad would finance and equip an anti-Zionist legion composed of neo-Nazi mercenaries from Germany as well as other countries. This so-called International Freedom Corps was supposed to assist Iraq if it came under attack by the United States. Kunin, the designated commander of the volunteer brigade, praised Saddam Hussein as a freedom fighter. Quote, "We have common ideals, the creation of living spaces for different people and races in accordance with their own culture and tradition," unquote. Referring to Kuwait as the Silesia of Iraq, unquote, Kunin claimed that Arabs were not Marxists, but nationalists, just like we are, unquote. Moreover, they had the same enemy, the United States and its backers, the Zionist forces, unquote. But the martial prowess of the neo-Nazis who pretentiously strutted around Baghdad in SS uniforms left much to be desired. As soon as the bombs started to fall on the Iraqi capital, Kunin's motley delegation scurried back to Europe. Kunin and his clique were not the only fascists who supported Saddam during the 1991 Gulf War. Franz Schoenhuber's Republikaner Party dispatched a representative to Baghdad, where he was warmly received by Iraqi leaders. Jean-Marie Le Pen of the French Front National also got the red carpet treatment when he met Saddam, and several British neo-Nazis ventured to Iraq shortly before the onset of the American-led blitzkrieg. South African white supremacists sent messages of support to Saddam as well. Not surprisingly, Kunin was quick to applaud when Iraqi scuds began hitting Israel. Even if Saddam Hussein used biological and chemical weapons, the German neo-Nazi chief maintained, he deserved respect for standing up to the United States. Kunin's bluster on behalf of Iraq was curiously in sync with the covert policy that Bonn had been pursuing for nearly a decade. with the full knowledge and cooperation of the federal government and its BND spy apparatus, dozens of German companies were instrumental in helping Saddam Hussein develop one of the world's most diversified unconventional warfare arsenals. Several of West Germany's biggest firms supplied equipment and expertise to set up entire plants for the production of nuclear, chemical, and biological weaponry. Other countries, including the United States, cashed in on the macabre bonanza that created Iraq's high-tech death machine during the 1980s, but Bonn's role far outstripped the international competition. In addition to constructing Saddam's underground bunker and extending the range of the Scud missiles to be able to hit Israel, German engineers concocted new delivery systems for poison gas and dispensed advice on the most efficient way to enrich uranium into weapons-grade fuel for a nuclear bomb. West German corporations, including Siemens and other firms that had profited from slave labor in Nazi concentration camps, were also involved in the construction of a chemical warfare factory in Rabta, Libya. And there were other Middle Eastern countries that benefited from the same kind of thing as well. Skipping ahead of the coincidence between the Kohl government's policy, that of many of the German corporations, by the way, as we looked at in For the Record 87, including the Thyssen firm in a big way, Martin A. Lee writes as follows, and note the German intelligence services training of intelligence agents for Iraq. More tensions between Washington and Bonn arose during the 1991 Gulf War. Disregarding the United Nations trade embargo, more than 50 German companies continued to provide Iraq with missile parts, chemical agents, and state-of-the-art engineering equipment right up until the United States attacked Baghdad. Once again, Chancellor Kohl ignored repeated requests by the U.S. government to probe these illicit business transactions. Later, it would be disclosed that the BND had trained Iraqi and Libyan secret police units. Germany's willingness to go its own way in the international arena would result in sharp arguments with its Western allies in the months ahead. So note that not only the Bush family, with its connections to the Third Reich and through the intelligence community and the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization to the Underground Reich, as well as to the Thyssen firm's links to the Underground Reich. Note that not only the Bush administration, but obviously the German power structure itself, its political, national security, and economic structures, and Saddam Hussein all have a common heritage in the Third Reich. Saddam Hussein being the political protege of his uncle, Khairullah al-Tufah, who was a key supporter of Ali Rashid in the pro-Nazi uprising that we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, including, For the Record, 369. More about support for Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War, and note again the flouting of the trade embargoes against Iraq, the flouting of the international community by Germany under Helmut Kohl. It is the U.S.'s divergence from the international community that had been the focal point of German criticism of the Bush administration. But note again the common heritage that elements of the German power structure, the Bush family, and elements of the Republican Party and Saddam Hussein all have a heritage going back to the Third Reich and or the Underground Reich. A person we've looked at in numerous programs who represents just such a bridge between the Third Reich, the post-war Nazi elements that found their way into various countries' intelligence communities, and also so-called neo-Nazis in Germany, specifically the Deutsche Volksunion, the DVU, one of the top German neo-Nazi parties, and that is Gerhard Frey, a person who received funding from U.S. intelligence for his anti-communist efforts in the post-war period, a person who himself had close connections to the Bruderschaft and to the SS Odessa Underground, and who also became a figure whose name crops up in connection with the Kennedy assassination, and who also helped to finance Vladimir Zhirinovsky, and who in later years took a distinctly anti-American and pro-Iraqi stance. That is Gerhard Frey, the editor of the Deutsche National Zeitung. Even by turning to The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee, even before he formed the DVU in 1971 with the professed objective to, quote, save Germany from communism, unquote, Frey received behind-the-scenes support from General Reinhard Gehlen, Bonn's powerful spy chief. But after the superpower face-off ended, the DVU Führer quickly shifted gears and demanded that Germany leave NATO. His newspapers began to run inflammatory articles that denounced the United States and praised Russia as a more suitable partner for post-war cold Germany. Fry also joined the chorus of neo-Nazi agitators who expressed solidarity with Saddam Hussein and condemned the U.S.-led war against Iraq in 1991. And still more about Jean-Marie Le Pen's support for Saddam Hussein. Bear in mind that along with Franz Schoenhuber and Ahmed Huber, Jean-Marie Le Pen attended the Mont Pelerin summit conference, so to speak, of top European rightist leaders, and apparently an unnamed American far-right leader was present as well. Turning now to discussion of Jean-Marie Le Pen and his pro-Saddam stance, we read, with the USSR out of the picture, anti-Americanism became more pronounced among right-wing radicals. Atlantic-oriented extremists such as Jean-Marie Le Pen gravitated closer to those who previously espoused pan-European third-position views. At the same time, Le Pen began to distance himself from Washington. This shift became evident when the Front National leader praised Saddam Hussein as a great, quote, Arab patriot, unquote, and condemned the American-led war against Iraq. I would note that Jörg Haider, the head of the Freedom Party in Austria, part of a now disintegrating coalition government in Austria, also expressed solidarity with Saddam Hussein against the United States. And Jörg Haider, late last year, that was early in 2002, Jörg Haider made a trip to Baghdad and expressed his support for Saddam Hussein against the United States, and again denouncing the United States as a Zionist entity. Now, again, one of the things that I'm proposing in connection with the situation in Iraq, not only is it possible, and I want to stress this is conjectural, not only is it possible that perhaps Saddam Hussein or somebody trying to ape what Saddam Hussein might do, for example, various neo-fascist elements associated with the underground Reich, either Saddam Hussein or somebody perhaps acting as a proxy for Saddam Hussein may have been involved in bioterror incidents, perhaps against the United Kingdom in connection with the foot and mouth outbreak, or perhaps against the U.S. with the West Nile virus outbreak. I wonder, and again, these are questions I'm asking, not statements I'm making. I wonder whether perhaps those outbreaks were more than just the natural occurrences that we were told. Again, in connection with the saber-rattling vis-a-vis Iraq, and I think much of the skepticism that is being expressed by people around the world about Bush distracting from domestic problems, as well as the petroleum interests that he represents looking to get their hands on the oil of Iraq, I think those are well-founded considerations, but I suspect there's much more to it than that. And I am afraid that we are being lured into a pre-structured trap, so to speak, in which the underground Reich, its Islamo-fascist and secular Arabo-fascist allies, and their allies in the United States will basically destroy the United States, either a la Serpent's Walk with a biological warfare attack, and or perhaps simply economically as well. All that's going to happen for the United States to be destroyed is for George Bush to remain in power with his economic program, his Maginot missile defense, as I call it, and his enormous increases in the defense budget while attempting to slash revenues. I will toss the gauntlet down to any student of history to show me a leader who successfully slashed revenues while trying to fund a war. It don't work, and what is looming perhaps even larger for the United States than the possibility of bioterrorism or a dirty bomb or something like that, and that is the U.S. current accounts deficit, which, all other factors remaining the same, that will destroy the United States and its economic power, which is the foundation of its worldwide political power. I also want to recall for listeners the evidentiary tributaries linking the first World Trade Center attack through Operation Bojinka to the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th, and there are a number of evidentiary tributaries connecting those, and we've looked at that in numerous programs, as well as links running to the Oklahoma City bombing and to the AMIA bombing in Argentina, and we've looked at that in the past as well. There are a number of accounts of a Middle Eastern slash Iraqi connection to Timothy McVeigh. We've looked at some of the Islamo-fascist and Middle Eastern evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of Oklahoma City. In For the Record 88, number 92, number 330, 336, 349, and I'm going to review an element from For the Record number 373 right now. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from an article called The Terrorist Motel by Jim Crogan, C-R-O-G-A-N, from the L.A. Weekly of July 26th through August 1st of 2002. And there were a number of accounts by eyewitnesses that a motel very distant from Oklahoma City and from Norman, Oklahoma, where Mohammed Atta and company were going to be taking flying lessons at a motel apparently used by Timothy McVeigh and unnamed Middle Eastern or Iraqi associates. One reason for the FBI's apparent lack of interest in this motel might be this motel's alleged connection to Timothy McVeigh and a group of Iraqis who worked in Oklahoma City. According to the motel owner and other witnesses and investigators interviewed by The Weekly, McVeigh and several of these Iraqis were motel guests in the months preceding the 1995 bombing. Witnesses also claimed they saw several of the Iraqis moving barrels of material around on the bed of a truck. The motel owner said the material smelled of diesel fuel and he had had to clean up a spill. Diesel fuel was a key component of the truck bomb that blew up the federal building. The motel owner said he and his staff reported this information to the FBI in 1995. We did have an ATF agent come out and collect the originals of the room registrations for that period, but we never heard back from them. And I never could get the registrations returned. He added that his previous experience with the FBI made him reluctant to contact them about Zacharias Moussaoui. But I decided it was my duty to tell them what had happened, so I did, unquote. Former Oklahoma City TV reporter Jaina Davis has also interviewed motel staff and former guests. In the process, she collected signed affidavits about their contacts with McVeigh and the Iraqis. She tried twice to give the Bureau this information, but the FBI refused to accept her materials. The Weekly's law enforcement source said he would review Davis's material and considers it credible. Last December, I personally took the documents of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, he said. I told them they should do their own investigation, unquote. The response was not encouraging. He said he was later informed that the Bureau brought in an analyst, quote, but I was told it would probably go nowhere. They were afraid the whole Oklahoma City bombing can of worms would be opened up, and the FBI would have to explain why they didn't investigate this material before, unquote. Within a week or so of this program being aired, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of the program listing all of the sources and with text excerpts in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. At WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, WFMU.org/Dave Emery, and a longer URL. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 380, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Part 3, being recorded on September 30th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.